Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, with you every Saturday afternoon here on News Talk 580 KMJ and online at kmjnow.com. You probably know that with December here, Pearl Harbor Day is around the corner. December 7th, of course, is Pearl Harbor Day. I hope that you'll look into events in your hometown to honor the legacy of that day that has lived in infamy. And today we will meet a man who was there that Sunday morning in Honolulu. He can tell us quite a story about how he experienced it. And in fact, he is going to be there this December 7th to dedicate the new Pearl Harbor Visitor Center. It isn't quite finished yet, but it's going to remain open while they finish construction over the next couple of years. And Tuesday, on the 69th anniversary of those infamous attacks, the $58 million project is going to be dedicated. The man you'll hear from today will be there. I recorded this interview earlier this week. I had to be in Salt Lake City for a Bulldog basketball game at Utah. How about that Fresno State football game last night, by the way, a 25-23 win over Illinois. But while I was in Utah, not only did I get a real impressive taste of how that state is honoring its veterans, I got to sit down with 91-year-old Marion Kessler and listen to how he experienced December 7th, 1941, aboard the USS Hulbert. Here's the beginning of that conversation with Mr. Kessler. You're going to Pearl Harbor. It's going to be a lot warmer there. What made you want to go this year to another reunion at Pearl Harbor?
Some of my family's going with me, so we'll be over there about 6 days.
Now, you've been there many times before, but what do you think will make this trip special?
I'm hoping it's the last.
Well, next year will be the 70th anniversary, so you've got to go for that, don't you?
If I'm alive.
Well, you were a very young man in 1941. You joined the service in August of 1940, you said, right? August of 1940. Why did you decide to join the Navy?
I could see the things kind of going over Europe, and it was eventually going to get us in it, too. So I didn't want to be drafted into the Army, so I went in one day, Salt Lake City, and volunteered for the Navy at the Navy recruiting station in there. Went back home, and about a week or two, they called me and told me to come into, he'd be inducted and sworn into the Navy. From there, I was sent down to San Diego Boot Station. I was there for about 3 months, boot training. Then, when we finished boot camp, we were sent on a ship down to Pearl Harbor, and the ship I was assigned to then was USS Hulbert. It was a seaplane tender. Originally, it was a destroyer that was completed in 1941 before it was put in mothballs, and then when everything started blossoming up over there in Europe, they pulled a bunch of these out of, I think it was about six of these, they were destroyers at the time. They tore them down, put a 30,000 gallon high test fuel tank in one of the boiler rooms. And then they fixed us up so it would be a Catalina tender. We took care of the crews of these Catalina flying boats.
I want to talk to you more about that, but let me ask you, as a guy who grew up in Utah, surrounded by all the snow, Pearl Harbor, being stationed in Hawaii, must have been a paradise for you. I bet that felt pretty nice.
Yes, it certainly was. They didn't have to get out and shovel snow over there anyway. And after I was over there, I met a lot of the guys I'd call shipmates after I was assigned there.
In the months leading up to December 1941, did you and your fellow sailors have any kind of inkling that things were getting close, that you could be attacked any day? Did you have any idea that something was about to happen?
No, we had no idea. You know, the Japanese were over here talking peaceful things and all that, and we had no idea. The closest thing that I saw, a ship's cook and I was on the quarter deck of the ship. We were just out talking around, and we heard some planes coming in out of the sun, coming on in out of the sun. And he looked up there, and now this guy I was talking to had been in the Navy many years ago. So we saw this plane coming down, and they made a circle around there, and then we saw this one plane that was so close to us, we could see the pilot in the front. And he says, those are Japanese planes. And so his battle station was a 50 caliber machine gun. And he dashed up to that and opened it up. And in the meantime, I run back to the after crew quarters and told them we were getting bombed and get up 30 battle stations. They said, go up and get us some more food. I was taking them food at the time. And they said, you're crazy. And I said, well, come up and watch. And then just pretty quick, they sort of heard the machine guns going off and also a few bombs going off. Then they woke up to the fact we were at war.
So you happened to be on deck. You saw those first planes coming in. You went below deck, and they thought you were making it up?
They thought it was crazy. Thing is this guy, the guy that I was talking to, he went up and manned his machine gun, 50 caliber, I should say, and he aimed at this plane that was so close off the stern of our ship. About the second burst, and it brought that plane down, and that plane fell down in the water and exploded when it hit the water. And so we were given credit for being the first ship to open fire that morning.
And it was your cook who shot down the plane.
His name was Wally Mortensen.
And you were there helping him, what, load the ammunition or putting the ammunition in belts?
I was loading ammunition into the... That's the first time I've seen 50 caliber bullets. I was loading them into a belt. I was putting them into a belt. Man, about three or four other guys, and as soon as we get a belt made, they'd send it up the machine guns.
So you had never had any kind of training for that before. This was just spur of the moment. You had to do it.
I didn't even know that there's 50 calibers on top of the galley deck house.
What was going through your mind? Because you obviously had signed up for the Navy because you knew something was going to happen, but what did that feel like in that moment to see, wow, this is really happening?
I thought, well, that's probably what I've signed up to. To do what I could in the Navy, so, and I definitely wanted to go in the Navy. I didn't want the Army, so I was satisfied that it was going to happen. I was there, see it, and participate in it.
So those were the first shots fired at the Japanese planes coming in. Your cook shot one of them down. How long did this last with you firing at the planes? I bet it felt like forever, but how long did it really last for your ship?
It lasted a couple of hours, but there was so many explosion going on and shooting going. All we had was 50 caliber machine guns, but some of the other ships in the harbor had 5-inch AA guns, and when they exploded in the air, you could hear them. It was quite exciting. The only thing is they took our motor whale boat and took it up to pull some dead people out of the water from them. We were tied up to submarine base. When for where we were, we could see down the street, down the channel, maybe half mile or so, we could see the battleships in. And we watched several of them. We watched the Oklahoma capsize. And the California, some of the others we couldn't see because they were covered in front of other ships. The Arizona, we couldn't see that because it was on the other side of our eyesight. We could see this superstructure, but we couldn't see the ship itself.
And I imagine you talked about your ship being a seaplane tender and having that huge gas tank near the boiler room. Did it ever occur to you that if you guys did get hit, it was going to be one big boom?
Yeah, we realized that we wouldn't be able to watching it anymore because it was pretty scary. But then anytime you're in a wartime, anything's scary. There's explosion going all around. From our wake, we saw the destroyer Shaw exploded. And I think it was a bomb hit a magazine and exploded. And it sent up a great big huge fireball. We were just a little across the bay from the Navy Yard when that exploded.
You probably didn't have time to think much, but did you wonder if it was ever going to end? I mean, how intense was it?
Well, it was about 2 hours, and it was pretty well over. And after that, things started settling down and then doing what you could. And then they started getting the men that they could off the ships and rescuing them when they could. That night, we were ordered to go to our advanced base and went to Kaneohe to service our Catalinas. And that night as we were going out to channel, we saw a periscope. We know what a periscope was. And it was coming upwind from down there. And we was starting to go out the channel, and that was coming up the channel. And so we were ordered, they told the big shots up in the Navy, they said that run back and forth, try to ram it. My ship didn't have any sonar system to listen for subs up. So we scraped the conning tower, that baby sub, for a while. And it's interesting to see those little bars. And so we couldn't hit it. So later on, I think the destroyer Ward was sitting in there, and they found it. And so later on, they was able to raise that. But after that, we were told to go back and tie up the submarine base again.
When did it hit you, the magnitude of the devastation there? I mean, was it looking out the next morning when the sun came back up and seeing everything that was there? When did it hit you that a lot of lives were lost and this was a huge country-altering event?
Well, one of the things that really hit me was that night some of the guys listening to Tokyo Rose over the radio, the announcement came over that there was 90 Jap transports sighted off Barber Point. And I can imagine that we all knew what had happened then, but that was propaganda. But if they had been there, they could have probably taken the Hawaiian Islands. Reading that rising sun over the Pacific, and that's that whole book tells how Japan was getting ready to come up and eventually take the Hawaiian Islands.
Well, and if things had been a little different that day, it could have been a lot worse for the Americans. We're going to take our first commercial break. When we come back, we'll talk more with Marion Kessler about what he saw at Pearl Harbor and the rest of his time in World War II. He'll be back at Pearl Harbor for this 69th anniversary of that day that lives in infamy. You're listening to Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, a Pearl Harbor edition, as we look forward to Tuesday, December 7th. I hope that you'll have a chance to take part in a commemoration in your community. Our guest today, Marion Kessler, will be at the site. He will be at the USS Arizona Memorial, where the new visitor center will be dedicated this Tuesday in Honolulu. He's been there several times before, and he was there December 7th, 1941. He's been telling us about that. Before we dive back into his story, I want to let you know, if you are anywhere close to Fresno and you're free this coming Tuesday morning, I hope you'll make your way to a free event that is so worth your time. It won't be too long till there won't be any Pearl Harbor survivors to commemorate that solemn day, but we still have a few of those fine folks left in the San Joaquin Valley, and you can go witness how they honor Pearl Harbor Day. The 69th annual remembrance at Fresno's VA Medical Center will start with a moment of silence Tuesday morning at 9:55, 69 years to the minute from when the first Japanese planes attacked. Get there early so you can get a seat. I have a basketball game in San Diego that day, so I can't make it. And if you can, do me a favor. Say hello to my survivor friends like the Lishmans from Coarse Gold. We'll get back to Marion Kessler in a moment, but first, let's turn on the time machine and listen to President Franklin Delano Roosevelt speaking on December 8th, 1941.
Yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy, the United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked by naval and air forces of the Empire of Japan. The United States was at peace with that nation, and at the solicitation of Japan, was still in conversation with its government and its emperor, looking toward the maintenance of peace in the Pacific. Indeed, 1 hour after, Japanese air squadrons had commenced bombing in the American island of Oahu. The Japanese ambassador to the United States and his colleague delivered to our Secretary of State a formal reply to a recent American message. And while this reply stated that it seemed useless to continue the existing diplomatic negotiations, it contained no threat or hint of war or of armed attack. It will be recorded that the distance of Hawaii from Japan makes it obvious that the attack was deliberately planned many days or even weeks ago. During the intervening time, the Japanese government has deliberately sought to deceive the United States by false statements and expressions of hope for continued peace. The attack yesterday on the Hawaiian Islands has caused severe damage to American naval and military forces. I regret to tell you that very many American lives have been lost. In addition, American ships have been reported torpedoed on the high seas between San Francisco and Honolulu. The facts of yesterday and today speak for themselves. The people of the United States have already formed their opinions and well understand the implications to the very life and safety of our nation. As Commander-in-Chief of the Army and Navy, I have directed that all measures be taken for our defense. But always will our whole nation remember the character of the onslaught against us. No matter how long it may take us to overcome this premeditated invasion, the American people in their righteous might will win through to absolute victory. With confidence in our armed forces, with the unbounding determination of our people, we will gain the inevitable triumph, so help us God. I ask that the Congress declare that since the unprovoked and dastardly attack by Japan on Sunday, December 7th, 1941, a state of war has existed between the United States and the Japanese Empire.
Isn't it neat to hear a little bit more of that speech than we usually hear just a few seconds of once a year? It really does take you back. And let's get back now to Marion Kessler and hear more of this 91-year-old's perspective on Pearl Harbor. When you go back there now and you see the drops of oil still bubbling up from the Arizona underneath the water, what does that mean to you? And how powerful is of an experience is that for you to go back to where it all started?
Yeah, it just makes me, our slogan is Pearl Harbor Survivors Association. We're trying to awake to the public so you don't get caught asleep again.
Remember Pearl Harbor, keep America alert?
Yes.
What did it mean for you guys at the time? I mean, I know that you told us you got into the service because you knew what was happening in Europe and you saw a war coming. But how motivated to fight the Japanese were you after what you saw there?
Oh, yes. I thought you were going to ask me if I hated the Japanese all these years. I'll answer that. I'm right now driving a Toyota.
That answers it loud and clear. And there is such a human side to war that goes beyond the countries involved. But I imagine that there was a bit of a rallying factor among the sailors. Is that fair to say that you were more motivated and more united after that?
Oh, yes. Because it all one thing, to win the war.
Was there anything that anyone said or maybe something you saw that's a powerful memory for you from that time?
Not really. It's just doing what you could do. You're trained to go to your battle station. That's what you're trained to do. You're always ready for it.
So from there, you guys were in Hilo. And I imagine after you've been the victim of a surprise attack, you probably wonder when the next one's going to come. How did you deal with that, with not knowing when something else would happen?
Well, that's one thing is you just don't know. You have to be alert all the time. And so you just never know when you're going to. When we went up all the way up the Aleutians that way, we didn't know if it was going to get torpedoed by a submarine or that. We didn't have a sonar system. We didn't have another ship to go with us. We were out there alone going up to the Aleutian Islands. We know there was some Japanese submarines around, but we just lucked out, I guess, that we didn't get hit.
And that's a long way from Hawaii to the Aleutian Islands, a long way to be going by yourself. What kinds of things did the Hulbert, the USS Hulbert, was the seaplane tender, later a destroyer that you served on. What kinds of things did you guys participate in the Aleutians?
Took on supplies up there, and we were anchored there in Massacre Harbor in Attu. We took care of the PBYs that were flying all over the area up there. Stay alive for hours and hours patrolling, looking for enemy whatever.
During that time that you were up there, the American troops had to actually take back that island of Attu, correct?
Oh, yes. We watched the army go up, kick the Japanese out, and take it again. Yes, we watched that.
Where'd you watch it from? Did you have some field glasses on the ship? How did you watch it?
Yeah, we had field glasses. We were watching them. Also, we were watching from the on the four-inch guns that we had on there, they had telescope on those, and we could look through that and watch the American man going up there. We could see him climbing up the mountain, and then all at once, you'd hear a rat-a-tat-tat of a machine gun, and then they'd come and run, jump back in the snow and come all the way down, and it'd go up again. But after the mortars bombed them quite a bit from down below, eventually they did kick him out. I didn't get over to Kiska, but I was right there at two.
And what were your duties during this time on the Hulbert? What kinds of things were you tasked to do?
I was striking to be a ship's cook. And as being a ship's cook on the ship, you have to cook meals for the crew, and then also I had to bring up stores from down the holes down below.
Well, I'm sure you always had all the supplies you needed to cook for that ship, right?
Oh, yes. We had everything you pretty well needed.
You never had to improvise?
Not to know of.
What kinds of things were those sailors eating? What kinds of things were you cooking up?
Oh, we had the roast beef. You had just like you normally now. The only thing is we didn't have a bakery on our ship. And so usually whenever we got bread, is when we got by a big ship, we'd usually go over there and get about 25, 30 loaves of bread from them because we'd be in communication with them. And later on, we got a baker that was able to. So they didn't get too many cakes and pies because we didn't have the facilities to do that on our ship. So that's the reason we got bread from big ships.
Well, there's one culinary commodity that I've heard so many Navy veterans talk about, that if their ship had this, they were very happy, and if their ship didn't, they were pretty jealous. Ice cream. Did you guys have ice cream aboard the Hulbert?
No. Whenever we got a chance to go on another ship, this big that had that, we went over there and got some, but we didn't have ice cream. We had a freezer on the ship. We could make cold drinks and stuff like that, but we had the ice cream.
So when you went to other ships to get ice cream, you always took that with their knowledge or sometimes without their knowledge?
No, we had to usually pay for it, just like we do on our ship. Yeah. No, it was quite interesting going on these big ships for everything that they had. We pretty well had. We didn't The morale was real good. We had, there was nothing special, I don't think, we needed. One thing the Navy guys did, they drank a lot of coffee. That's what kept them alive, I think. The guys were on the watch for, you went on watch for 4 hours, and that's about what they lived on to keep them alive, awake, is coffee and not much else. They just went to their battle stations and stayed where they were.
We're getting a little taste of what it meant to be a tin can sailor in the World War II Navy. And there's more to come, more from Marion Kessler when we come back. And we'll also hear about a very successful effort to save stories like the ones you hear on this program. Hometown Heroes will be right back on News Talk 580 KMJ.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Let's get back to my conversation with 91-year-old Navy veteran Marion Kessler of Salt Lake City, Utah. As we speak, he is in Honolulu getting ready for the dedication of the new Arizona Memorial Visitor Center on Tuesday, the 69th anniversary of the day that has lived in infamy. Marion served on the USS Hulbert, which we'll hear him discuss more now. Your guys' role was still to be there for these PBY Catalinas that were flying around. A lot of times those planes would go on rescue missions.
We'd replace, gas them up, and then if they'd, when we first went up the Aleutians, we put big bombs on those Catalinas could carry bombs, and so they think they could carry about 4 bombs. And we'd put bombs on them, and if they'd been using the 50 caliber machine guns, they could use those. We could put those on them too. But we took care of the crews once. And they were always glad to come in to have aboard a nice warm ship.
I bet that was my next question. How was the interaction between those crews on those PBYs and the guys who were actually aboard ship all the time? Did you guys get along pretty well? Was there a little bit of a rivalry going there?
No, there's none at all. We were always glad to see them, and they were glad to see us, because we were what's able to keep them alive, flying with all that gasoline we carried for them.
Now, I know, and this sounds pretty tame, everything we've been talking about in the Aleutians, but there was a pretty scary event that would end up happening in 1943. I believe it was June of 1943, and I'm sure the Hulbert wasn't the only ship affected by this, but pretty bad storm up there in the Alaska area?
Oh, you bet. That's where the weather is made up there. A willow walk can come up with no... This one storm come up at... Came up so fast, we didn't have time to get the boilers lit and get steam up and get out. You have a better chance riding it out at sea, but if we didn't get steam up, so we couldn't get out, and so the wind just blew us on. We were lucky; it was a sandy beach, so we was able to use. It took a couple of weeks, and they finally got us off, pulled us off of there.
Where were you when that was happening? I imagine that would be a pretty helpless feeling to know that your ship has no power, you're at the mercy of Mother Nature, and, oh yeah, there's some land over there, and your ship's headed for it.
But you won't believe this, but we went over there and lived with the Army for about 3 weeks while I was on the beach. And the cook that was on the ship went over and cooked there with the Army. Our crew went over there and ate with the Army, too. So that's the way we got along. It was strange, though, you know, all the power's gone. We had to get rid of a lot of our provisions. We had ice boxes and refrigerators and all that on the ship. So the Army was glad to get our eggs and fresh meat and stuff like that. And our guys liked to get their canned goods, like canned soup, canned butter, all that stuff.
It's always greener on the other side, isn't it?
But it was interesting. Our officers and enlisted men, if they ate it, they get in chow lines, just like the Army. So we found out how the Army lived.
And your ship was damaged pretty badly?
Yeah, the part of the keel was bent. It kind of damaged the superstructure, not the superstructure, but some of the bottom of the ship. So they fixed it up enough, and we were seaworthy to go back, to be towed back down to Bremerton. And that's where they fixed us down there. But it was a little scary being towed off that ocean, and we don't know when there's a submarine might raise up and really fix us up good.
I imagine that those 3 weeks stranded in Alaska probably weren't a lot of fun either. You're a long way from home. You don't know when you're going to get to leave. What kind of kept you going and kept you motivated and kept you positive through that time?
Just eventually this war would be over. We'll go home. That's what kept us living from one life thought to another.
Did you ever get any mail from home or any correspondence with anyone?
Not up there, no. We didn't get any for quite a while until we come back down to Bremerton, Washington. Yeah, your letters are far and few between up there.
That probably made it mean quite a bit when you did get a letter.
Oh, you bet. The only thing is once in a while we might see a ship that would be carrying mail up to us and we have to get it from there, but not very often. You're busy fighting war.
And so after your ship was repaired in Bremerton, was that pretty much the end of the war for you, or did you still have more to do?
No, it wasn't the end because you heard of these baby flat tops, haven't you? Well, that's what they sent us. They didn't know how seaworthy we were after repairing the ship. They sent us, they put the anti-aircraft guns on the sonar and sent us. They sent us down to San Diego, and we went out on the screen to from these baby flat tops. We escorted them out there, and we didn't really have, we didn't worry about submarines down there and what they did with us. So we were kind of to rescue if any pilots couldn't, if they landed on the flat top and got wrecked or something over the side, and then they couldn't make it. They had a wreck on the side, or they go out and they couldn't, something went wrong with the plane. We went out, if the guy was still alive, we went out and rescued him.
When you say baby flat tops, those are those escort carriers that were a little smaller than the full aircraft carriers.
A big cargo ship was converted into, they just made it a flat top.
And they basically made you guys into what we'd know as a destroyer, right? You're a destroyer escort?
Yeah, that's what we are. Mm-hmm.
Or a tin can.
Tin cans. The reason they call it tin cans, the average life of a tin can in battle is about 5-10 minutes.
Made you want to see a battle, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah. I was like, glad to see the big ships.
Did it ever make you feel vulnerable or expendable to know what role you played and that you were there to protect the bigger, more important ship?
No, it just make you feel the best, better. Eventually you'd get this whole thing would be over and you'd go home.
You mentioned having to pick up downed pilots. What was that like emotionally, and what did you see out of those men? I imagine they were pretty thankful to be picked up.
Yes, they were. We're always glad to go pick them up, and then we treated them real good. Dried them off, and eventually put them back on their own ship.
And you were probably one of the first guys they wanted to see when they got out of that cold water.
Oh, yeah. Well, down in San Diego, it wasn't too cold water down there. But they were always glad to see us come up to them with our motor whale boats over and pick them up and bring them back to our ship.
You've mentioned a few times that you were looking forward to the war being over. It would have been nice if they told you when it was going to be over so you knew, huh?
Oh, it would have been nice. But it's ironically that when I knew the war was over, I was on leave down in Delta, Utah, when we got word that the war was over. I was down there, and it was really to celebrate with the people back home. The war was open.
So that's some pretty good news for you, because you probably figured you're going back to your ship to go fight some more battles.
I'd signed up for 6 years from the Navy, and so I still had time to serve, and so I was sent back down to Pearl Harbor.
And it occurs to me that here we are talking in Utah, which is where you're from, where you live today, and Utah had an important role in the war coming to an end with the testing of the bomb group that did a lot of testing here before they dropped those atomic bombs.
Yes, over there in Wendover, they had that planes ready to drop the atomic bomb, yeah.
I've noticed, too, that, and I know the University of Utah here in Salt Lake City has had a project recording oral histories of veterans. They do a big Veterans Day celebration every year. What does it mean to you to be a Utah veteran of World War II, and how do you think you veterans have been received here in this state?
I think we've been received real well, and I'm just happy that it's over and that they accept all the veterans real good, and it feels good to be home.
You mentioned being here when the war was over. Can you put into words what that meant to you and how that changed your outlook? Did it make you feel like you had a future again, where for a while you probably wondered whether you did or not?
Oh, yes. It made everybody feel real good, because then you could start life all over again and or resume it where it was.
Now, when did you get married in all this timeline here?
September 10, 1944, dear. 44. Yeah, September 10, 1944.
So that war was over, and you were actually home with your bride?
We were living in San Diego, so see, I still had time to serve, and so we were living down in San Diego.
Well, I bet that knowing that the war was over, then you could start a family, and now there's kids and grandkids and great-grandkids that wouldn't be here if you hadn't made it through.
Sounds like a good deal, and I'm glad that I was able to participate and do my part.
Throughout your whole war experience, I'm sure you've been asked this before, what was the most hair-raising moment for you, or the moment that made you wonder the most whether you were going to make it through? What do you think was the toughest experience that you had to endure?
That night when we heard it from Tokyo Rose, it saying that our ship was sunk, and then also when we heard that there was 90 Jap transports sighted off of Barber's Point, that was a scary.
Now tell me again, who all's going to Pearl Harbor with you?
Well, my dear wife, my daughter, and she has her daughter and a son going over.
So you have three generations of your family going to Pearl Harbor, where it all started so many years ago, and you were there. When you talk to them about that day and World War II as a whole, and you're 91 years old, you said yourself you don't know if you'll be around to make it next year to Pearl Harbor. When you talk to them about it, what do you want them to remember about that day in particular and that war in general?
I just want them to remember that we're all proud of the United States and the flag that we was fighting for, and to support the good old, dear old flag of the United States. And I still look up to it.
Is there anything that I haven't asked you about that you think we ought to know about either your ship, the guys you served with?
Oh, no, I think you've pretty well covered most of it. You know, a lot of little details you forget.
Well, thank you for serving our country, and I hope you have a wonderful time at Pearl Harbor.
Well, I think we're getting all set. We're looking forward to some warm weather.
I bet you are. It's a little cold here in Utah. Well, that's Marion Kessler, 91 years old, of Salt Lake City, Utah. Now, on my trip to the Beehive State this week, I got to watch some tremendous work by KUED, the public television station for the state of Utah. I started recording veteran stories about 5 years ago, and so did KUED, and that station has also teamed up with a tremendous program at the University of Utah. So when we come back, we're going to hear a little bit about how veteran stories are being preserved there. This show is called Hometown Heroes because no matter where your hometown is, I'm convinced there are heroes in your midst. We'll hear how they are saving the legacy in Utah when Hometown Heroes continues next on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Now, more Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. A little different twist now. We'll move on from Mr. Kessler, the World War II veteran. You heard his story about Pearl Harbor, and we hope that he has a wonderful time there this coming week. But now we're going to get a little different angle on it. You've heard me talk before about some of the efforts here in California that are preserving the stories of our World War II veterans. And there are some great efforts in the state of Utah preserving stories of veterans from all generations. I'm joined now by Matt Basso, the director of the American West Center at the University of Utah. Their project, Saving the Legacy, has been going on for nearly a decade now. Matt, I understand more than 500 veterans you guys have recorded their stories?
That's right, Paul. Thanks for mentioning our project. We're pretty excited about it. We've been doing it now for over a decade, and started by one of my colleagues, wonderful faculty member here, Dan McCool, whose father himself was a World War II veteran. Dan learned during that interview that his dad had some remarkable, as your listeners will understand, experiences at the Battle of the Bulge. And that's just one sampling of the remarkable stories that these veterans have come forward with, and we've been excited to be a big part of that, doing that many interviews. But we also are affiliated with other groups around Utah, and of course, we encourage friends and family to record veterans if they haven't already done that. It's critical that we get these voices on tape before we lose these men and women.
Amen to that. And I was curious about the origins. You've been the director for 4 years. You talk about McCool and his father. My grandfather was at the Battle of the Bulge, kind of the reason that I got started doing this kind of thing 5 years ago. Was that the major impetus, you think, his own personal desire to get his father's story and thinking there are other guys out there like him?
I think it was, Paul. But at the same time, really the country had woken up to the idea that we needed to record these veterans. And so beginning in the 80s, in sort of fits and starts, but especially in the 90s, we started a major national effort led by the Library of Congress to record the veterans of all wars, but especially World War II. We were losing that generation of men and women quite quickly. And the Library of Congress's Veterans Oral History Project has become the major repository for these interviews. We're just hopeful that we don't necessarily forget this model. That is to say that we need to make sure that we get the experiences of other veterans from other combat zones and other wars on tape really as soon as possible.
And so that's something you're doing there at the University of Utah. You're interviewing guys that are pretty fresh off the war zones in Iraq and Afghanistan?
We are. We've got a second or third year now of our Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans Oral History Project, and we're pretty excited to take it on. The memories of veterans change over time, as all of our memories do, and thus these oral histories that are early in their time back on the home front are pretty critical. That doesn't say that the oral histories that are taken years later are less valuable. It's just to say that in our perspective, we should try to get some of these voices, some of these memories as soon as possible. Now, it's a different sort of oral history because for a lot of these men and women, the experience is fresh and often difficult to talk about. And indeed, that has been one of the hesitations of other oral historians over the years, is that we felt veterans simply might not want to talk about their experience that soon after being in combat.
I can certainly identify with that phenomenon. I want to ask you, Matt, I know you served 4 years in the Army yourself, but in terms of your interaction with veterans, whether they're World War II or more recent, what's the overwhelming sense that you get of what it means to them to have their stories told and to know that people are going to remember, that it won't be forgotten?
For the World War II veterans, really, that's the classic example. Many of those men didn't feel comfortable talking about their experience for quite a few decades, and I think that's for multiple reasons. It's not simply just because the memories or traumas were too fresh. I also think we just were sort of in a culture that didn't feel comfortable talking about the more difficult aspects of war, right? I mean, war is brutal, and we need to remember that. In regard to the more contemporary veterans' experience, I think they feel the same thing, but we're in a society now, for good or ill, that much more quickly talks about things. That's part of the blogosphere and things like that, but folks want to know the story of these veterans, and I think that's to our credit, that we want to try to find out as soon as possible what the experience of war is, and often what the ravages of war are, because it's critical for us to factor that in as we consider U.S. policy and matters along that line.
We're talking to Matt Basso, the director of the American West Center at the University of Utah. The Saving the Legacy Project has cataloged the stories of more than 500 veterans over more than a decade. Another thing I wanted to ask you, Matt, in terms of the students that you see working on this project, how do you see them benefiting from the experience? What would maybe be the more prevalent feedback you get from students in terms of the lasting impact it has on them?
Well, the students really come to a much deeper and almost transformative understanding of the U.S. place in the world, of how veterans experienced life overseas, how they experienced combat, what it might mean for us to have certain policies, and so forth. And they hear it from men and women that were on the front lines of that conflict. In our particular case, we go out of our way to hire former veterans to help us with our oral history projects. And for those folks, it's also been really a kind of astonishing, eye-opening experience. They always understood abstractly that their experience of war was unusual, that it was specific to them. But once they start hearing their comrades in arms talk about that, it really crystallizes for them. And that's important, right? Because it makes us realize that the experience of war is complicated, and we need to hear from a lot of different people. Sometimes veterans have contradictory experiences, and we need to put all of those pieces together as we try to understand what exactly went on, and as we also try to think forward about policies and about our own approach to our engagement with the world.
Well, we're running short on time here, Matt, but in closing, is there anything else to share you'd like to share about your project there at the University of Utah and anything for people that maybe are thinking about recording the history of a family member, or they're thinking about maybe telling their own story, how you would encourage them to proceed?
Well, I'll say this, and I think probably some of your listeners have heard this before, but it warrants repeating. All of these stories are critical. Lots of men and women believe that their experience was mundane, whether it's in combat, in a war zone, or in life in general. But for historians, and really for society in general, we need as many voices recorded as possible. We need as many stories recorded as possible, because it's that overall composite portrait that's essential. And frankly, in almost every instance, and I would go as far as saying every instance, the story that folks tell who say they're going to be boring is a remarkable, wonderful story. It's not boring at all. So please get out there and record these memories and convince folks who have experienced some of the life-changing, monumental events in our recent history that they need to leave a record of what they experienced.
Amen. Well said, Matt. And thank you for serving our country, and thank you for the great service you're providing for veterans and our future generations.
Thanks, Paul, and thanks for doing the show.
Well, that is definitely my pleasure. Thank you, Matt. Utah is doing a great job there with the Saving the Legacy projects and all the efforts to preserve the stories of our veterans. In the weeks ahead, I'm going to be sharing more about the Veterans Oral History Project that's building major momentum at Fresno State. But we're just about out of time on today's program. I'll tell you one more time. If you are free Tuesday morning at 9:30, head down to the VA Medical Center on Fresno and Clinton for a local observance of the 69th anniversary of the attack on Pearl Harbor. You'll meet some incredible people who, like Marion Kessler, were there on that Sunday morning that changed the world. You'll be moved, and I guarantee you, you will not be disappointed. Thanks to Marion Kessler and Matt Basso from the fine state of Utah. For more information, go to kmjnow.com or check out the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook. I'll be back with you for Bulldog basketball tonight from Fort Collins, Colorado, and I'll be back next Saturday with another installment of Hometown Heroes here on News Talk 580 KMJ.